Mr. Watson, real, real far. What did you have to tell these servants to keep quiet about?
Oh, usually. Singing and music and playing some wretched instrument, making a real night of it. That's all. And sometimes pie dogs, they were a bit of a nuisance. That's a parrier dog, that's strays that they used to have congregating around.
Could you be easy with these servants around the house? Could you be relaxed? Or did you find that it was a bit hampering to have them around?
Oh, no, they made no... They invariably kept in the background, unless they were required. As a rule, one never... that's wrong. One didn't come in contact with the servants except the bearer unless they were called. The Memsahib, of course, dealt with a cook. She'd go into the kitchen and give him his orders, or he'd come and get his orders from her, and she would inspect the kitchen and see that it was kept clean. And apart from that, the Mali would get on with his own work outside, the sweeper would do his work when required, and the bearer would stay in the background and be ready to do anything when he was called. So that there was no question of anything but relaxation that way.
Did you ever have to find that you had to dismiss servants?
Oh, yes. Usually because their work was not up to what it should be. If you got dissatisfied, then the best thing was to get rid of him, tell him to go. Occasionally, of course, the servant himself would want to go away for some reason or another, family matters. One interesting incident of that was our Aya. She came from the eastern part of Assam. She was a very fine specimen of an ayah. She was very good. She was always beautifully turned out, wearing silk clothes, saris, and so on. And she was very good with her children. And one day she came and said she wanted to go back to see her family. She came from the Shan States, that's right, the Shan States. And she wanted to see her family, I can't remember why. Could she have leave for a fortnight? So we gave her leave and off she went by train. When she came back, she was very upset in her mind. The Indian used to call it ulta pulta, which means going round and round in circles. She used to wander around the compound and seemed completely at loggerheads, didn't sort of she didn't seem to be properly adjusted at all. Well, we called in our RMO and he said that she's been drugged. Well, in one of her more lucid moments, she was still attending to the children reasonably well. In one of her more lucid moments, it turned out that some Sikhs on the train had given her some of this datura, which is rather like the form of Indian hemp, and doped her in an effort to steal her bangles. And as a result of that, she was quite determined that she was going to die, and nothing, absolutely nothing, would change her mind on that. We got the RMO to try and explain to her, but he just could not get through. And after about a week, she just went back to her bed and lay on it and refused to get up. Well, we called her brother. We sent a telegram to her brother. We found out where he lived, and he came. And sure enough, she did die. She just gave up. Most extraordinary.
How old was she?
I suppose she was in her 30s. if that. Quite young.
Can we talk about your own attitude whilst you were a teacher in India, about your attitude to the different sections of the Indian community? Did you have any preferences for any particular group in the Indian community, like either from different parts of the country, like Bengal or Punjab or the Pathans, or different religious communities?
I don't think so. I don't think that anything like that ever entered one's head. They were all, to us, they were all Indians, regardless of their caste, their sect, their religion, anything like that. And of course, I think it would have been fatal if we had, because would have led to trouble of some kind or another. So there was no feeling towards any particular type at all.
What about rich and poor? Did you have
any
preference?
No, I didn't even know. As a rule, one just didn't know, unless one happened to meet... When I was principal, of course, I did meet a number of the parents, and one could judge then. But prior to that, I mean, I had absolutely no knowledge at all. The only possible indication would be just like in an English school, where one was doling out pocket money, because that came from the parent. And there were cases, of course, where one cadet would have considerably less pocket money than another. But apart from that, one had absolutely no idea, even if he was, whether he was a Brahmin or whether he was of a lower caste, quite apart from being rich or poor. There was just no indication, which is a very good thing, because I think that is one very strong point in favour of uniformity. If you have a uniformity like that, you're not going to have a distinction. And that's what happened when they all got into their college uniforms.
Were the cadets allowed, the Hindu cadets, allowed to have caste marks on their foreheads? Sect marks?
Yes, I can't remember them ever having, no. I doubt whether that would be the case except at some function where the boy was, introduced into some special form of religious ceremony. Then he probably would, but that would usually take place on the holidays anyway. During the term, it just didn't occur.
Do I understand then that you, as teachers, were given money by parents in the form of pocket money to be handed out to their children?
Yes, I see you say we were given money. It wasn't quite like that. They left money in with the principal or the adjutant, and that was entered up for the boy. And then there was a system whereby we had our own, what was known as a coffee shop, whereby the cadet could draw so much money up to the limit of what was actually allowed him. Then, of course, he could always buy things or have things bought, like tennis rackets, apart from that, which would be put on his bill in the normal way.
You said that for the boys at the college, the area outside the college or cantonment was out of bounds.
Yeah.
Did the staff have free access to local towns?
Oh yes, completely.
And did you make use of that very much?
Oh yes, rather, yes. Oh yes, a great deal. I mean, if ever we went shopping, of course, just like you do here. I mean, there was no distinction in that sense at all. And of course, then there was a club life in Dehradun itself, because the Dehradun Club was in the middle of the town, not in cantonments.
Did you ever feel uneasy at any time in India going about your business?
Never. Never once. Except perhaps the very first night when I landed in Bombay, I wondered what it had hit me, as it were. It was all very strange. I mean, all the noise and the hubbub and the bustle, and there was I in an eastern country and on my own. And it did seem strange then, but apart from that, no, never. Even during partition, there was no sense or hint of that at all.
Didn't you see any violence during partition?
I saw results of violence, yes, but not the actual violence. For instance, I remember it was rather difficult. The bearer was finding it difficult to get food because all the shops were being shut during the time of partition. So one day I went down into Dehradun and see if I could find any. The place was completely deserted except for one Britisher who ran a large motor garage and sales shop. And he was standing outside. This was early in the afternoon. He was standing outside there, surveying the whole vicinity. And I went up to him and I said, "What's happening?" And he said, "Well, look there." And he pointed, and there was, on the pavement, just quite near to him, there was great patches of blood where people had been killed. He said, "I saw that, but I couldn't do anything." And he said, "I know that they're going to burn down and loot this your contractor's shop if he doesn't do something about it. You better try and tell him." I said, "What about you?" And he said, "Oh, they've told me." He said, they're not after me at all." He said, "You're white. We're not interested in you. It's the Mohammedans we want." And what was happening, of course, was that they, whenever they found any Mohammedans, they just butchered them. All the Mohammedans in Dehradun just completely went into hiding. And there were one or two big Mohammedan shops, and they were all shuttered and barred, and some of them were looted. And as I mentioned, my contractor, who was a Mohammedan, we had the college contractor. I think I mentioned that earlier on. He had his own farm and so on, and I told him when I went back to the college that afternoon, I told him, I said, "Look, I've just had a warning that your shop is likely to be looted. I'll try and get a truck." I rang up district headquarters, asked them if they could provide us a truck, explained what I wanted it for, and they said, "We're terribly sorry, but all the trucks are out on parade at the moment, on duty all over the vicinity, trying to stop rioting. But we'll send you a truck as soon as we can." Well, I took Hazir down, and we went to the shop and opened it up, and he took out all the valuables that he could, things like watches and so on. There was not much else that he could do. We locked up again and came back and just waited in the college. Sure enough, a truck did come along, but of course by that time, it came along about 4:30, by that time it was too late. I rang up the garage fellow, the Englishman who was running this garage, and he said, "Oh, it's too late now. It has been looted, and the stuff scattered all over the pavement, and it was complete chaos there." And the police were chasing them, but of course they got away with an awful lot, and the pavements were littered with packets of food and all sorts of things. And they'd also attempted to burn down the little tailor's shop next door as well. Fortunately, not too seriously. It didn't burn very well, but they did do an awful lot of damage. And then, of course, in the villages outside, it really was very bad indeed. Wherever there was a Mohammedan community, the Sikhs mostly went in and just butchered the lot, and the whole villages were razed to the ground. I know there was one very bad one not very far from Dehradun. And there used to be a lot of Mohammedans up in Missouri, and they tried to get away. This was towards the end of the hot weather season, August, September. And the Sikhs used to just stop the buses on the way down and pull out the Mohammedans, and that was that. That was the end of the Mohammedans. The massacre was really bad. Of course, it was just as bad, I think, on the other side, on the western side of the Punjab, where there were a lot of Hindus and Sikhs, of course. And the Muslims just did as much damage there as the Hindus and Sikhs did in India. One of my staff, who came along later, he had two fingers missing from his hand. He'd been attacked in a train. He managed to survive, got over the border all right, but as I say, he'd lost two fingers. So that the trouble was pretty bad during the partition.
How did this affect the boys at the college?
Oh yes, now that was rather an important thing, because, as I say, one third of them were Mohammedans. Towards the end of September, I think it was, we had a telephone message from district headquarters, which was stationed in Dehradun, to say that we had to evacuate all the Muslims into Pakistan. This message came around 2:30 in the afternoon, and we were told that we, on no account must we let them know until a few hours before departure, otherwise there might have been trouble. The word might have got around, and of course there was always the possibility of people coming in from outside cantonments and causing trouble in the college itself. We had to be very careful about that. So we did nothing, of course, all day until 10:30 at night, when we went round all the dormitories and woke up all the cadets. Of course everybody woke up, and we told the Muslims that they had to get out of bed, get dressed, pack up all their belongings, because they were being evacuated to Lahore, which was in Pakistan. Well, of course, there was great excitement among the cadets. I don't think they fully grasped the whole situation. And the clothes, of course, were all over the place. Some were with a derby, a games kit, and anyway, we got them all sorted out and packed and ready, and about 2 o'clock in the early morning, along came a number of trucks from district headquarters, and the Mohammedans all clambered aboard. As they went, rather interesting thing, which I thought was most encouraging, just as they were leaving, the cadet captain, who was a Hindu, cried out three cheers for the Mohammedan cadets, and there was a sort of tremendous cheer from the cadets who remained behind. And I thought that was a very fine send-off. Well, going back to the Mohammedans, from there they went to the academy, picked up all the Muslim cadets there, and from there onwards they went to Saharanpur, which is about 40 miles away, under guard, of course. They had Gurkhas to guard them. And from Saharanpur they went by train across the border at Amritsar to Lahore, and from the Lahore they were dispersed to various places throughout the country. Incidentally, I learnt only a week or so ago that one of the cadets who was evacuated left his parents behind. The parents didn't know he'd even gone. They were living down in, I think, in Allahabad or somewhere down there, and he had to be evacuated with all the rest. And it wasn't until some years later that his parents were able to go across to Lahore, to Pakistan. A funny thing, too. After partition, there were more Mohammedans in India than there were in the whole of Pakistan. And I believe there still are. It's rather an astonishing fact. They're mostly congregated in particular parts of India.
Did you ever, apart from all the troubles at the time of partition, did you ever come across any evidence of political activity whilst you were in India? Did you see any demonstrations or political posters or anything about
that? There were certainly none in the college. No, I don't think we did. I think we were rather segregated that way, and we were completely non-political, being very much army-minded. And so we never saw anything like that at all. Dehradun was a comparatively peaceful place. Very peaceful, the town itself. We heard about plenty of riots and strikes and various things like that, and marches, but only through reading in the newspaper.
Wasn't Dehradun affected by the Quit India movement?
Yes, very much. Well, I say very much, just as much as anywhere else. I mean, for instance, although it was not, there was no trouble, I never had any trouble in going out. We were always met with slogans, sort of, quit India, British go home, British go home. But after about a month, when partition had been completed and things had settled down, there was an astonishing backflow. I mean, people were coming up to me and saying, Saab, why must you go? Why can't you stay? And the attitude of getting rid of the British was a thing of the past. I think it didn't take long for the average Indian in the street to realize that his lot was not improved after partition. In other words, politics had got a very firm stranglehold on the country, and that there was going to be an awful lot of corruption and bribery and nepotism, and things were not going to be easy. I had one or two examples of that myself. I remember, for instance, going down to Delhi. I had to go down occasionally to report to the Defense Department and at headquarters. And just before entering Delhi, you had to cross what was known as the Jamuna Bridge, and stopped there. There was an unfortunate Indian with his bullock cart loaded up with vegetables, which he was obviously taking in. He'd brought in from some village, outlying village, to sell in Delhi itself, and he'd been stopped by this policeman. And apparently I gathered that the policeman would not let him cross the bridge unless he paid the policeman a couple of rupees, which was typical of the attitude. And that was only on a small scale. And I mean, there was a tremendous lot of bribery and corruption going on on a larger scale.
What year would that be, that bullock cart incident?
That would be...
approximately...
1948.
When these individuals were telling you to get out of India, this was in the few months leading up to partition,
yes.
Did you say?
Yes.
But what about the Quit India movement that took place in 1942? There was a Quit India movement launched during the war, wasn't there? Did
yes.
that affect
no.
Dehradun?
Not at
all. You?
No. No, we led a sort of almost a monastic life in some ways. We were completely military in outlook and completely segregated. So that I think we were very fortunate indeed. And as I said, quite apart from that, Dehradun itself was always a peaceful place. There was never any trouble.
Did you make any close Indian friends whilst you were there? I mean, the type of friends with whom you would visit each other's houses.
Yes, but there again, mostly, I would say, apart from my staff, mostly the families of ex-cadets. I think that was practically the limit. And families in the academy, the military academy. Apart from that, I mean, one didn't come into very close contact. There were a few people in Dehradun that I knew very well, yes. I don't know that the Indian, apart from the military type, the Indian Memsahib is not inclined, or wasn't inclined very much, to go out to visit.
What was the reason for that?
I don't know. They led a secluded life, I think. I think it's partly education. I think that's really at the background of it, or at the back of it. I, for instance, had one of my staff. He was an extremely intelligent man. He spoke perfect English. In fact, he was an English English teacher. But his wife was completely uneducated. Of course, you see, there again, marriages were always, and still are, arranged. And it depends upon the parents' choice rather than anything else.
You said that most of your life revolved around the college, of course, but on what type of occasions did you get out to see the country outside, apart from what you've already said, like you've already mentioned shopping and going out to the clubs and so on? On what other occasions would you get out?
Well, of course, there was the hot weather when we would go up to the hill station and
To Mussoorie.
Mostly to Mussoorie. I mean, I have been also to Nainital, but it was generally to Mussoorie because it was so easy there. It was just up the road, as it were, 23 miles up the road. And one met a great number of people there, both English and Indian. But there again, it was very much social rather than anything else. People used to stay in two or three hotels up there, or rent bungalows. Then apart from that, we would go out to for a holiday somewhere, to Delhi, Agra, Allahabad, stay with people, or stay in an hotel and just go on a holiday like one does in England.